Waiting in the face of delay is among the hardest things that human beings do. In the scriptures that Harold read so well for us this morning, Jeremiah is addressing an exiled people who wonder if they will ever, ever get to go home, and if they will have a home worth going to. And in the Gospel of Luke, it's been probably 50 years since Jesus ascended into heaven. They're waiting for his return. Life's getting more difficult. Where is he? Why the delay? When our son Josh was about 6 years old, he had a very literal cast of mind. In some ways, he probably still does. We, all the family, David and I, three kids, a couple of friends of ours, were touring around Roanoke, where David had recently taken a position, and we had a car accident. But before we had that car accident, we had promised the kids that they could go to the dollar store, and they each had $2 or $3 of their own to spend. It was going to be amazing. Then we had, back in the day when that was really satisfying, right? That didn't last very long, but it was good while it did. So we spent a long time in the emergency room. I mean, it wasn't anything terrible, but we had to be x-rayed. Andrew had to get his forehead stitched up. The friend who was in the car was grabbed by her seatbelt, and she had a ruptured spleen. I mean, it went on and on and on. Finally, some dear nurse who was leaving her shift said to us, since my husband was the chaplain, David, I can give you a ride home. Well, I don't know how many of you have ever been in a little car accident, but you know, after it's been 4, 5, 6, 7 hours, you're pretty sore. It was all we could do to get in the car, put on those seat belts, and not scream. And after all this time, all these medical procedures, Josh, age 6, turns to us, it's probably 10 o'clock at night, and he says, "Are we going to the dollar store now?" "But you promised we would go, and I cannot believe you are breaking your promise. You promised." Well, there are times when we all feel that way. We wait for better health. We wait for a better relationship. We wait for a better job. We wait for a better insurance rate. We wait for safer neighborhoods. We wait for enough income. We wait for civility. When promises are made and then delayed, sometimes we pull away. We think, well, maybe we've been betrayed. Maybe the promise won't be kept at all. Maybe our confidence was ill-placed. We begin to lose faith in the one who made the promise. Husband and wife, employer and colleague, siblings, friends, colleagues, all kinds of people. But it becomes even more complicated if God is the one who has made the promise. And there's a delay. Jesus has not yet returned. The Hebrew people did not know what was going to happen on the other side of exile or what life would be like. So Jesus' followers cling to the promise. The promise that in time, God will bring all things to fruition. And Luke tells the story about a feisty widow. Now, this is a really interesting parable because in the times that Luke wrote, this widow who doesn't have any social status, who really doesn't have any power except to make a nuisance of herself, was the perfect symbol of the young Christian community. And the unjust judge was a perfect image of secular power. Now, a widow who didn't have any men folks, and she didn't seem to have any, obviously she didn't have a husband, she didn't seem to have a son or a nephew, somebody who could take up for her, had to go by herself. She went to that judge, she went to that judge, she went to that judge. Now, you might not think that water that drips on a rock has much effect, but after a while, what happens? Begins to make a dent, and if not, it's really irritating to listen to. And the judge, who symbolizes the world, who's completely indifferent to the cause of Christ, at best says, all right, before she drives me around the bend, even though I don't give a hoot about her, which is a clue that he's not a godly person, right? The Judeo-Christian tradition says, who do you take care of first? The widow, the orphan, the poor? He doesn't care about her. He says, in order to have a moment's peace, I'm going to give her what she wants. And so Jesus says to us in the waiting time, pray like that tough little widow. Pray and persist. Pray and persist. Because you never know when the cause of faith, the opportunity to make a difference, will come to you. How many of you remember those old Hebrew midwives in the Exodus story? You remember Pharaoh gives the word to the Hebrew midwives. If there is a male Hebrew baby boy born, what do you do with him? Kill him. Strangle him. Who are slave women to stand up to Pharaoh, right? Who has all the power? Who has none of the power? And yet, the people of God are always well placed. These Hebrew women, like the little widow, say, psht, we're not going to cooperate with that. By the time Pharaoh's folks check on the situation, they say, oh, those Hebrew women are just so vigorous. Long before we get there, the baby's born and in booties kicking. What can we do? The widow takes the opportunity that she has. The midwives take the opening that they have. We, in our life of faith, must take the openings that we have to stand firm and to choose faithfully the ways of God. Jeremiah, in his prophecy, said an unusual thing. It doesn't appear anywhere else in the Old Testament, the words new and covenant together. You know, the new covenant is the New Testament, right? So I guess it's not surprising that it usually doesn't appear in the old, except for Jeremiah. Jeremiah says there's going to come a time when we know the reign of God is breaking in, because two things will be true. One is, everybody will know God. We won't have to have Sunday school. We won't have to have youth group or catechism. You won't have to go to Bible study, because everybody will know. Everybody will be in relationship with God. That's a wonderful thought. It's why we send missionaries here and afar, in Waynesboro and in China, because folks don't know about the love of God. But the second thing that Jeremiah lifts up is even more extraordinary. That this new law written on human hearts is going to be characterized by forgiveness. That we are going to take all the old brokenness, all that delayed waiting that did not come out well, and God's going to throw it in the sea of forgetfulness so that we can start afresh. And we will be people with a new law, a law of tenderness, of God's love written on our hearts. You know, in the day and age in which we live, it is hard to keep a mellow heart, isn't it? I don't want to turn into a hard-boiled Christian, do you? One who says, I know what's right and wrong, and you're not going to affect me. Part of the gospel is keeping that tender heart upon which God's new covenant is written. In fact, if we were going to look at the compass points of balanced Christian discipleship, it would probably look something like keeping a tender, forgiving heart, working for justice and peace, living a life of personal integrity, and being joined to a community of faith from which we gain strength, to which we give strength in order to go out and be the love of God in the world. We have some amazing opportunities. We have some opportunities right now, at a time when it's deeply needed, to take our lives of prayer to a new level interceding for our beloved country and for our world. We've had a request this week from Raynell, West Virginia. They can use some help. They've been flooded out badly, and we have the skills to be helpful. Abigail Stern has come and talked to us about China today. Wave your hand, Abigail. If you haven't spoken to her yet, you're in for a treat. She spoke to our Sunday school class today. She's a midwife in China. That's probably not for the faint of heart, is it, Abigail? That takes some courage. We have the opportunity to be part of mission locally and globally. But most of all, we are called like those widows, like those midwives, like Ananias, who received Saul of Tarsus, to be steadfast in our own era. Have you ever thought about the conversion of St. Paul? Now, St. Paul, before he was St. Paul, was Saul of Tarsus, who in a Christian household would have been a little bit like entertaining Osama bin Laden or one of the guerrillas of ISIS. Saul of Tarsus was a man who killed Christians, and he was proud to do it. But when he had a profound conversion experience, God tapped on the shoulder a man in Damascus, poor Damascus, poor Syria, a man in Damascus on the street called Straight, which used to be a Christian neighborhood just a few years ago, and he said to Ananias, "There is a guy coming whom you are going to receive and to whom you are going to give hospitality because he's going to be one of my best servants." And Ananias, we can imagine, saying, "Well, that's lovely. How will I know when I meet him?" "Oh, well, it's Saul of Tarsus." "What? What? I've got a wife and children. You want this guy in my house?" And yet, Saul of Tarsus becomes the great apostle, without whom it would be very difficult to imagine Gentile Christianity, of which we are a part, most of us. We are here to stand our ground faithfully, in a divisive time to refuse to be divided, in an uncivil time to be loving, in a time of terrible partisan pulls to seek the common good, because that is what God seeks for us and for all of humanity. Delayed promises are still promises in the Christian communion that will be kept. But Jesus' question to us is, when I do return, will I find faith? That's our job, to respond, "Yes, Lord. Our lamps are lit. We're at work. We're waiting." Amen.